The surgeon stumbled into the corridor and made his way to his own room. There he hurled the apron across a chair and slumped to his bed, lacking even the energy to pull a blanket across his body. Sleep would not come. Nightmare images of agony and horror flitted across his mind, and he began to sob. A face entered his mind, elderly and gentle. The face grew, absorbing his anguish and radiating harmony. Larger and larger it became, until, like a warm blanket, it covered his pain. And he slept, deep and dreamless. "He rests now," said Vintar, as Rek turned away from the window in the keep. "Good," said Rek. "He won't rest much tomorrow. Serbita, have you had any more thoughts about our traitor?" The albino shook his head. "I don't know what we can do. We are watching the food and the wells. There is no other way he can affect us. You are guarded, as are Dras and Virai." "We must find him," said Rek. "Can you not enter the mind of every man in the fortress?" "Of course. We would surely have an answer for you within 3 months." "I take the point," Rek said, smiling ruefully. Kitan stood silently, watching the smoke billow up from his towers. His face was expressionless, his eyes dark and shrouded. Ulrik approached him, placing a hand on his shoulder. "They were just wood, my friend."
"Yes, my lord. I was thinking that in future we need a false-fronted screen of soaking hides. It should not be too difficult, though the increased weight could prove a problem in terms of stability."
Ulrik laughed. "I thought to find you broken with grief, and yet already you plan."
"I feel stupid, yes," answered Kitan. "I should have foreseen the use of the oil. I knew the timbers would never burn merely from fire arrows, and gave no thought to other combustibles. No one will beat us like that again."
"Most assuredly, my learned architect," said Ulrik, bowing. Kitan chuckled.
"The years are making me pompous, my lord. Deathwalker did well today. He is a worthy opponent."
"Indeed he is. But I don't think today's plan was his. They have white Templars among them who destroyed Nostar Khan's acolytes."
"I thought there was some devilry in that," muttered Kitan. "What will you do with the defenders when we take the fortress?"
"I have said that I will slay them."
"I know. I wondered if you had changed your mind. They are valiant."
"And I respect them. But the Drenai must learn what happens to those who oppose me."
"So, my lord, what will you do?"
"I shall burn them all on one great funeral pyre. All save one, who shall live to carry the tale." An hour before dawn, Kaisa slipped silently into Druss's room and approached the bedside. The warrior was sleeping deeply, lying on his belly with his massive forearms cradling his head. As she watched him, Druss stirred. He opened his eyes, focusing on her slender legs, clad in thigh-length doeskin boots. Then his gaze travelled upwards. She wore a body-hugging green tunic with a thick, silver-studded leather belt that accentuated her small waist. By her side hung a short sword with an ebony handle. He rolled over and met her gaze. There was anger in her tawny eyes.
"Finished your inspection?" she snapped.
"What ails you, girl?"
All emotion left her face, withdrawing like a cat into shadows.
"Nothing. Turn over, I want to check your back."
Skillfully, she began to knead at the muscles of his shoulder blade, her fingers like steel pins, causing him to grunt occasionally through gritted teeth.
"Turn over again."
With Dras once more on his back, she lifted his right arm, locked her own arms around it, and gave a sharp pull and twist. A violent cracking sound followed, and for a fraction of a second, Dras thought she had broken his shoulder. Releasing his arm, she rested it on his left shoulder, then crossed his left arm to sit on the right shoulder. Leaning forward to pull him on his side, she placed her clenched fist under his spine between the shoulder blades, then rolled him back. Suddenly she threw her weight across his chest, forcing his spine into her fist. Twice more he grunted as alarming sounds filled the air, which he identified as a kind of crunching snap. Sweat beaded his forehead.
"You're stronger than you look, girl."
"Be quiet and sit up, facing the wall." This time she seemed almost to break his neck, placing her hands under his chin and over his ear, wrenching first to the left and then to the right. The sound was like a dry branch snapping. "Tomorrow you rest," she said as she turned to leave. He stretched and moved his injured shoulder. He felt good, better than he had in weeks.
"What were those cracking sounds?"
he asked, halting her at the door.
"You have arthritis. The first three dorsals were locked solid, therefore blood could not flow properly. Also, the muscle under the shoulder blade had knotted, causing spasms, which reduced the strength to your right arm. But heed me, old man. Tomorrow you must rest. That or die."
"We all die," he said.
"True. But you are needed."
"Do you dislike me, or all men?" he asked, as her hand touched the door handle.
She turned to look at him, smiled, pushed the door shut, and came back into the room, stopping within inches of his burly, naked frame.
"Would you like to sleep with me, Dras?" she asked sweetly, laying her left arm across his shoulder.
"No," he said softly, gazing into her eyes. The pupils were small, unnaturally so.
"Most men do," she whispered, moving closer.
"I am not most men."
"Are you dried up, then?" she asked.
"Perhaps."
"Or is it boys you lust after? We have some like that in our band."
"No, I can't say I have ever lusted after a man. But I had a real woman once, and since then I have never needed another."
She stepped away from him. "I've ordered a hot bath for you, and I want you to stay in it until the water cools. It will help the blood to flow through those tired muscles." With that, she turned and was gone. For a few moments, Dras stared at the door. Then he sat down on the bed and scratched his beard. The girl disturbed him. There was something in her eyes. Dras had never been good with women, not intuitive as some men are. Women were another race to him, alien and forbidding. But this child was something else again. In her eyes was madness. Madness and fear. He shrugged and did what he always had done when a problem eluded him. Forgot about it. After the bath, he dressed swiftly, combed his hair and beard, then snatched a hasty breakfast in the Eldebar mess hall, and joined the 50 volunteers on the battlements as the dawn sunlight pierced the early morning mist. It was a crisp morning, fresh with the promise of rain. Below him the Nadir were gathering, carts piled with boulders, making their slow way to the catapults. Around him there was little conversation. On days such as this, a man's thoughts turned inward. "Will I die today? What is my wife doing now? Why am I here?" Further along the battlements, Orin and Hogun walked among the men. Orin said little, leaving the Legion General to make jokes and ask questions. He resented Hogun's easy style with the enlisted men, but not too deeply. It was probably more regret than resentment. A young cool Bregan, was it, made him feel better as they passed the small group of men near the gate tower. "Will you be fighting with Karnak today, sir?" he asked.
"Yes. Thank you, sir. It is a great honor for all of us."
"It's is nice of you to say so," said Orin.
"No, I mean it," said Bregan. "We were talking about it last night."
Embarrassed and pleased, Orin smiled and walked on. "Now that," offered Hogan, "is a greater responsibility than checking supply lines."
"In what way?"
"They respect you, and that man hero worships you. It is not an easy thing to live up to. They will stand beside you when all have fled,
or they will flee with you, when all else stand.
I won't run away, Hogan, said Orin.
I know you won't. That's not what I meant. As a man, there are times when you want to lie down, or give in, or walk away. It's usually left to the individual, but in this case, you are no longer one man. You are 50. You are Karnak. It is a great responsibility.
And what of you? Asked Orin.
I am the Legion, he answered simply.
Yes, I suppose you are. Are you frightened today?
Of course.
I'm glad of that, said Orin, smiling. I wouldn't like to be the only one.
As Druss had promised, the day brought fresh horror. Stone missiles obliterating sections of battlements, then the terrible battle cries and the surging attack with ladders to the wall, and a snarling horde breasting the granite defence to meet the silver steel of the Draenei. Today it was the turn of 3,000 men from Musif, Wall 2, to relieve the warriors who had fought long and hard the day before. Swords rang, men screamed and fell, and chaos descended for long hours. Druss strode the walls like a fell giant, blood-spattered and grim, his axe cleaving the Nadir ranks, his oaths and coarse insults causing the Nadir to centre upon him. Rek fought with Serbitar beside him, as on the previous day, but with them now were Menahem and Antaheim, Virai and Arbadak. By afternoon, the 20-foot-wide battlements were slippery with blood and cluttered by bodies. Yet still the battle raged. Orin, by the gate towers, fought like a man possessed, side by side with the warriors from Group Karnak. Bregan, his sword broken, had gathered a Nadir axe, two-headed and long-handled, which he wielded with astonishing skill.
"A real farmer's weapon!" yelled Gilad, during a brief lull.
"Tell that to Druss!" shouted Orin, slapping Bregan on the back.
At dusk, the Nadir fell back once more, sent on their way by jeers and catcalls. But the toll had been heavy. Druss, bathed in crimson, stepped across the bodies and limped to where Rek and Serbitar stood cleaning their weapons.
"The wall's too damned wide to hold for long," he muttered, leaning forward to clean Snaga on the jerkin of a dead Nadir.
"Too true," said Rek, wiping the sweat from his face with the edge of his cloak.
"But you are right. We cannot just give it to them yet."
"At present," said Serbitar, "we are killing them at a rate of 3-1. It is not enough. They will wear us down."
"We need more men," said Druss, sitting back on the battlements and scratching his beard.
"I sent a messenger last night to my father at Druss Segril," said Serbitar. "We should have reinforcements in about 10 days.
"Drada hates the Draenei," said Druss. "Why should he send men?"
"He must send my personal bodyguard. It is the law of Vagria, and though my father and I have not spoken for 12 years, I am still his firstborn. It is my right. 300 swords will join me here. No more than that, but it will help."
"What was the quarrel?" asked Rek.
"Quarrel?" queried the albino. "Between you and your father?" "There was no quarrel. He saw my talents as gifts of darkness and tried to kill me. I would not allow it. Vintar rescued me."
Serbitar removed his helm, untied the knot that bound his white hair, and shook his head. The evening breeze ruffled his hair. Rek exchanged glances with Druss and changed the subject.
"Ulrich must realize by now that he has a battle on his hands."
"He knew that anyway," answered Druss. "It won't worry him yet."
"I don't see why not. It worries me," said Rek, rising as Virai joined them with Menahem and Antaheim. The 3 members of the 30 left without a word, and Virai sat beside Rek, hugging his waist and resting her head on his shoulder.
"Not an easy day," said Rek, gently stroking her hair. "They looked after me," she whispered. "Just like you told them to, I suppose."
"Are you angry?"
"No."
"Good. We have only just met, and I don't want to lose you yet."
"You two ought to eat," said Druss. "I know you don't feel like it, but take the advice of an old warrior."
The old man stood, glanced back once at the Nadir camp,
and walked slowly towards the mess hall.
He was tired, almighty tired.
Ignoring his own advice, he skirted the mess hall and made for his room at the hospital. Inside the long building, he paused to listen to the moans from the wards. The stench of death was everywhere. Stretcher bearers pushed past him, bearing bloodied corpses. Orderlies hurled buckets of water to the floor. Others, with mops or buckets of sand, prepared the ground for tomorrow. He spoke to none of them. Pushing open the door of his room, he stopped. Kaiser sat within.
"I have food for you," she said, avoiding his eyes.
Silently, he took the platter of beef, red beans, and thick black bread, and began to eat.
"There is a bath for you in the next room," she said as he finished.
He nodded and stripped off his clothing. He sat in the hip bath and cleaned the blood from his hair and beard. When cold air touched his wet back, he knew she had entered. She knelt by the bath and poured an aromatic liquid into her hands, then began washing his hair. He closed his eyes, enjoying the sensation of her fingers on his scalp. Rinsing his hair with warm, fresh water, she rubbed it dry with a clean towel. Back in his room, Druss found that she had laid out a clean undervest and black woolen trousers, and had sponged his leather jerkin and boots. She poured him a goblet of Lentrian wine before leaving. Druss finished the wine and lay back on the bed, resting his head on his hand. Not since Rowena had a woman tended to him in this fashion, and his thoughts were mellow. Rowena, his child bride, taken by slavers soon after the wedding at the Great Oak. Druss had followed them, not even stopping to bury his parents. For months he had travelled the land until, at last, in the company of Seban the poet, he had discovered the slavers' camp. Having found out from them that Rowena had been sold to a merchant who was heading east, he slew the leader in his tent and set out once more. For 5 years he wandered across the continent, a mercenary, building a reputation as the most fearsome warrior of his time, becoming at last the champion of Ventria's god-king, Gorben. Finally he had found his wife in an eastern palace and had wept, for without her he had always been only half a man. She alone made him human, stilling for a while the dark side of his nature, making him whole, showing him the beauty in a field of flowers, where he looked for perfection in a blade of steel. She used to wash his hair and stroke the tension from his neck and the anger from his heart. Now she was gone, and the world was empty, a shifting blur of shimmering grey, where once there had been colours of dazzling brightness. Outside, a gentle rain began to fall. For a while, Druss listened to it, pattering on the roof. Then he slept. Kaiser sat in the open air, hugging her knees. Had anyone approached her, they could not have seen where the rain ended, and the tears began.
Chapter 22. For the first time, all members of the 30-manned Eldibar, as the Nadir massed for the charge. Servitar had warned Rek and Druss that today would be different. No ballistae bombardment, merely an endless series of charges to wear down the defenders. Druss had refused all advice to rest for the day and stood at the center of the wall. Around him were the 30, in their silver steel armor and white cloaks. With them was Hogun, while Rek and Virai stood with the men of Group Fire, 40 paces to the left. Orin remained with Karnak on the right. 5,000 men waited, swords in hands, shields buckled, helms lowered. The sky was dark and angry, huge clouds bunching to the north. Above the walls, a patch of blue waited for the storm. Rek smiled suddenly, as the poetry of the moment struck him. The Nadir began to move forward in a seething, furious mass, their pounding feet sounding like thunder. Druss leapt to stand on the crenellated battlements above them.
"Come on, you horsehands!" he bellowed. "Deathwalker waits!"
his voice boomed out over the valley, echoed by the towering granite walls. At that moment lightning split the sky, a jagged spear above the dross. Thunder followed, and the bloodletting began. As Serbitar had predicted, the center of the line suffered the most ferocious of attacks, wave upon wave of tribesmen breasting the walls to die under the steel defense of the 30. Their skill was consummate. A wooden club knocked Druss from his feet, and a burly Nadir warrior aimed an axe blow at his skull. Serbitar leapt forward to block the blow, while Menahem dispatched the man with a throat slash. Druss, exhausted, stumbled over a fallen body and pitched to the feet of three attackers. Arbidark and Hogan came to the rescue as he scrabbled for his axe. The Nadir burst through the line on the right, forcing Orin and Group Karnak away from the battlements and back onto the grass of the killing ground. As Nadir reinforcements swept over the wall unopposed, Druss saw the danger first and bellowed a warning. He cut two men from his path and raced alone to fill the breach. Hogan desperately tried to follow him, but his way was blocked. Three young colts from Karnak joined the old man as he hammered and cut his way to the walls, but they were soon surrounded. Orin, his helm lost, his shield splintered, stood his ground with the remnants of his group. He blocked a wide, slashing cut from a bearded tribesman and lanced a return thrust through the man's belly. Then he saw Druss, and knew that, save for a miracle, he was doomed. "With me, Karnak!" he yelled, hurling himself into the advancing mass. Behind him, Bregan, Gilad, and 20 others surged forward, joined by Bar Britan and a squad of stretcher guards. Serbitar, with 15 of the 30, clove a path along the walls. The last of Druss's young companions fell with a broken skull, and the old warrior stood alone as the Nadir circle closed about him. He ducked beneath a swinging sword, grabbed the man's jerkin, and smashed a headbutt to his nose. A sword blade cut his upper arm, and another sliced his leather jerkin above the hip. Using the stunned Nadir as a shield, Druss backed to the battlements, but an axe blade thudded into the trapped tribesman and tore him from Druss's grasp. With nowhere to go, Druss braced his foot against the battlements and dived forward into the mass. His great weight carried them back, and several tumbled to the earth with him. He lost hold of Snaga, grabbed at the neck of the warrior above him and crushed his windpipe, then, hugging the body to him, waited for the inevitable killing thrust. As the body was kicked away, Druss lashed out at the leg beside him, sweeping the man from his feet.
"Whoa, Druss! It's me, Hogan!"
The old man rolled over and saw Snaga lying several yards away. He stood and snatched up the axe.
"That was close," said the Legion Gun. "Yes," said Druss. "Thank you. That was good work. I would like to take the credit, but it was Orin and the men from Karnak. They fought their way to you, though I don't know how."
It had begun to rain, and Druss welcomed it, turning his face to the sky with mouth open, eyes closed.
"They're coming again!"
someone yelled. Druss and Hogan walked to the battlements and watched the Nadir charge. It was hard to see them through the rain. To the left, Serbitar was leading the 30 from the wall, marching silently back towards Musiv. "Where in hell's name are they going?" muttered Hogan.
"There's no time to worry about that," snarled Druss,
cursing silently as his shoulder flamed with fresh agonies.
The Nadir horde swept forward. Then thunder rumbled, and a huge explosion erupted at the center of the Nadir ranks. Everything was confusion as the charge faltered.
"What happened?" asked Druss.
"Lightning struck them," said Hogan, removing his helm and unbuckling his breastplate. "It could happen here next. It's all this damned metal." A distant trumpet sounded, and the Nadir marched back to their tents. At the center of the plain was a vast crater surrounded by blackened bodies. Smoke rose from the hole. Druss turned and watched the 30 enter the postern gate at Musiv.
"They knew," he said softly. "What manner of men are they?"
"I don't know," answered Hogan. "But they fight like devils, and at the moment that's all I care about."
"They knew," Druss said again, shaking his head.
"So?"
"How much more do they know?"
"Do you tell fortunes?" the man asked Anterheim, as they crouched together beneath the makeshift canvas roof, with five others from group fire. Rain pattered on the canvas and dripped steadily to the stones below. The roof, hastily constructed, was pinned to the battlements behind them and supported by spears at the two front corners. Within, the men huddled together. They had seen Antaheim walking alone in the rain, and one of the men, Kul Rabil, had called him over, despite the warnings of his comrades. Now an uncomfortable atmosphere existed within the canvas shelter.
"Well, do you?" asked Rabil.
"No," said Antaheim, removing his helm and untying the battle knot in his long hair. He smiled. "I am not a magician, merely a man, as you, all of you, are. My training is different, that's all."
"But you can speak without talking," said another man. "That's not natural."
"It is to me."
"Can you see into the future?"
asked a thin warrior, making the sign of the protective horn beneath his cloak.
"There are many futures. I can see some of them, but I do not know which will come to pass."
"How can there be many futures?" asked Rabil.
"It is not an easy concept to explain, but I will try.
Tomorrow an archer will shoot an arrow. If the wind drops, it will hit one man. If the wind rises, it will hit another. Each man's future therefore depends on the wind. I cannot predict which way the wind will blow, for that too depends on many things. I can look into tomorrow and see both men die, whereas only one may actually fall."
"Then what is the point of it all? Your talent, I mean," asked Rabil.
"Now that is an excellent question, and one which I have pondered for many years."
"Will we die tomorrow?" asked another.
"How can I tell?" answered Antaheim. "But all men must die eventually. The gift of life is not permanent."
"You say gift," said Rabil. "This implies a giver."
"Indeed it does."
"Which then of the gods do you follow?"
"We follow the source of all things." "How do you feel after today's battle?"
"In what way?"
asked Rabil, pulling his cloak closer about him. "What emotions did you feel as the Nadir fell back?"
"It's hard to describe. Strong,"
he shrugged.
"Filled with power. Glad to be alive."
The other men nodded at this.
"Exultant?" offered Antaheim.
"I suppose so. Why do you ask?"
Antaheim smiled. "This is Eldebar, Wall 1. Do you know the meaning of the word Eldebar?"
"Is it not just a word?"
"No, it is far more. Egil, who built this fortress, had names carved on every wall. Eldebar means exaltation. It is there that the enemy is first met. It is there he is seen to be a man. Power flows in the veins of the defenders. The enemy falls back against the weight of our swords and the strength of our arms. We feel, as heroes should, the thrill of battle and the call of our heritage. We are exultant. Egil knew the hearts of men. I wonder, did he know the future?"
"What do the other names mean?"
Antaheim shrugged. "That is for another day. It is not good luck to talk of Musiv while we shelter under the protection of Eldebar." Antaheim leaned back into the wall and closed his eyes, listening to the rain and the howling wind. "Musiv, the wall of despair. Where strength has not been great enough to hold Eldebar, how can Musiv be held? If we could not hold Eldebar, we cannot hold Musiv. Fear will gnaw at our vitals. Many of our friends will have died at Eldebar, and once more we will see, in our minds, the laughing faces. We will not want to join them. Musiv is the test. And we will not hold. We will fall back to Karnia, the wall of renewed hope. We did not die on Musiv, and Karnia is a narrower fighting place. And anyway, are there not three more walls?
The Nadir can no longer use their ballistae here, so that is something, is it not? In any case, did we not always know we would lose a few walls? Sumitos, the wall of desperation, will follow. We are tired, mortally weary. We fight now by instinct, mechanically and well. Only the very best will be left to stem the savage tide. Balteri, Wall 5, is the wall of serenity. Now we have come to terms with mortality. We accept the inevitability of our deaths, and find in ourselves depths of courage we would not have believed possible. The humor will begin again, and each will be a brother to each other man. We will have stood together against the common enemy, shield to shield, and we will have made him suffer. Time will pass on this wall more slowly. We will savor our senses, as if we have discovered them anew. The stars will become jewels of beauty we never saw before, and friendship will have a sweetness never previously tasted. And finally, Gedon, the wall of death. I shall not see Gedon, thought Antaheim. And he slept.
Tests! All we keep hearing about is that the real test will come tomorrow. How many damn tests are there? Stormed Elikas.
Rek raised a hand as the young warrior interrupted Serbitor. Calm down, he said. Let him finish. We have only a few moments before the city elders arrive. Elikas glared at Rek, but was silent after looking at Hogan for support and seeing his almost imperceptible shake of the head. Drass rubbed his eyes and accepted a goblet of wine from Orin.
I am sorry, said Serbitor gently. I know how irksome such talk is. For 8 days now we have held the Nadir back, and it is true I continue to speak of fresh tests. But you see, Ulric is a master strategist. Look at his army. It is 20,000 tribesmen. This first week has seen them blooded on our walls. They are not his finest troops. Even as we have trained our recruits, so does he. He is in no hurry. He has spent these days culling the weak from his ranks, for he knows there are more battles to come when, and if, he takes the dross. We have done well, exceedingly well, but we have paid dearly. 1,400 men have died, and 400 more will not fight again. I tell you this, tomorrow his veterans will come.
And where do you gain this intelligence? Snapped Elikas. Enough, boy, roared Drass. It is sufficient that he has been right till now. When he is wrong, you may have your say.
What do you suggest, Servitor? Asked Rek. Give them the wall, answered the albino.
What? Said Virai. After all the fighting and dying, that is madness.
Not so, my lady, said Bowman, speaking for the first time. All eyes turned to the young archer, who had forsaken his usual uniform of green tunic and hose. Now he wore a splendid buckskin topcoat, heavy with fringed thongs, sporting an eagle crafted from small beads across the back. His long blonde hair was held in place by a buckskin headband, and by his side hung a silver dagger with an ebony haft shaped like a falcon, whose spread wings made up the knuckle guard. He stood. It is sound good sense. We knew that walls would fall. Eldebar is the longest and therefore the most difficult to hold. We are stretched there, almost if we would need fewer men, and therefore would lose fewer. And we have the killing ground between the walls. My archers could create an unholy massacre among Ulric's veterans before even a blow is struck. There is another point, said Rek, and one equally important. Sooner or later we will be pushed back from the wall, and, despite the fire gullies, our losses will be enormous. If we retire during the night, we will save lives.
And let us not forget morale, Hogan pointed out. The loss of the wall would hit the dross badly. If we give it up as a strategic withdrawal, however, we will turn the situation to our advantage.
"'What of you, Orin? How do you feel about this?' asked Rec.
"'We have about 5 hours. Let's get it started,' answered the gun.
Rec turned lastly to Drass.
"'And you?'
The old man shrugged.
"'Sounds good,' he said.
"'It's settled, then,' said Rec. "'I leave you to begin the withdrawal. Now I must meet the council.'
Throughout the long night, the silent retreat continued. Wounded men were carried on stretchers, medical supplies loaded onto handcarts, and personal belongings packed hastily into kit bags. The more seriously injured had long since been removed to the Musiv Field Hospital, and Eldebar barracks had been little used since the siege began. By dawn's first ghostly light, the last of the men entered the postern gates at Musiv and climbed the long, winding stairways to the battlements. Then began the work of rolling boulders and rubble onto the stairs to block the entrances. Men heaved and toiled as the light grew stronger. Finally, sacks of mortar powder were poured onto the rubble and then packed solid into the gaps. Other men with buckets of water doused the mixtures.
"Given a day," said Marek, the builder, "that mass will be almost immovable."
"Nothing is immovable," said his companion, "but it will take them weeks to make it passable, and even then the stairways were designed to be defensible."
"One way or another, I shall not see it," said Marek. "I leave today."
"You were early, surely," said his friend. "Marissa and I also plan to leave, but not until the fourth wall falls."
"First wall, fourth wall, what is the difference? All the more time to put distance between myself and this war. Ventry has need of builders, and their army is strong enough to hold the Nadir for years."
"Perhaps. But I will wait."
"Don't wait too long, my friend," said Marek.
Back at the keep, Rek lay staring at the ornate ceiling. The bed was comfortable, and Virai's naked form nestled into him, her head resting on his shoulder. The meeting had finished 2 hours since, and he could not sleep. His mind was alive with plans, counter-plans, and all the myriad problems of a city under siege. The debate had been acrimonious, and pinning down any of those politicians was like threading a needle under water. The consensus opinion was that Delnok should surrender. Only the red-faced Lentrian, Malfar, had backed Rek. That oily serpent, Chanel, had offered to lead a delegation to Ulrich personally. And what of Beric, who felt himself tricked by fate in that his bloodline had been rulers of Delnok for centuries, yet he had lost out by being a second son? Bitterness was deep within him. The lawyer Bagda had said little, but his words were acid when they came. "You seek to stop the sea with a leaking bucket." Rek had struggled to hold his temper. He had not seen any of them standing on the battlements with sword in hand. Nor would they. Horeb had a saying that matched these men. "In any broth, the scum always rises to the top." He had thanked them for their counsel and agreed to meet in 5 days' time to answer their proposals. Virai stirred beside him. Her arm moved the coverlet, exposing a rounded breast. Rek smiled, and for the first time in days, thought about something other than war. Bowmen and 1,000 archers stood on the ramparts of Eldebar, watching the Nadir mass for the charge. Arrows were loosely notched to the string, hats tilted at a jaunty angle to keep the right eye in shadow against the rising sun. The horde screamed their hatred and surged forward. Bowmen waited. He licked his dry lips.
"Now!"
he yelled, smoothly drawing back the string to touch his right cheek. The arrow leapt free with 1,000 others to be lost within the surging mass below. Again and again they fired until their quivers were empty. Finally Kaiser leapt to the battlements and fired her last arrow straight down at a man pushing a ladder against the wall. The shaft entered at the top of the shoulder and sheared through his leather jerkin, lancing through his lung and lodging in his belly. He dropped without a sound. Grappling irons clattered to the ramparts.
"Back!"
yelled Bowman, and began to run across the open ground, across the fire gully bridges and the trench of oil-soaked brush. Ropes were lowered, and the archers swiftly scaled them. Back at Eldebar,
The first of the Nadir had gained the wall. For long moments they milled in confusion before they spotted the archers clambering to safety. Within minutes the tribesmen had gathered several thousand strong. They hauled their ladders over Eldebar and advanced on Musiv. Then arrows of fire arced over the open ground to vanish within the oil-soaked brush. Instantly the thick smoke welled from the gully, closely followed by roaring flames twice the height of a man. The Nadir fell back. The Drenai cheered. The brush blazed for over an hour, and the 4,000 warriors manning Musiv were stood down. Some lay in groups on the grass. Others wandered to the 3 mess halls for a second breakfast. Many sat in the shade of the rampart towers. Russ strolled among the men, swapping jests here and there, accepting a chunk of black bread from one man, an orange from another. He saw Rek and Virai sitting alone near the eastern cliff, and wandered across to join them.
"So far, so good," he said,
easing his huge frame to the grass.
"They're not sure what to do now. Their orders were to take the wall, and they've accomplished that."
"What next, do you think?" asked Rek.
"The old boy himself," answered Russ. "He will come, and he'll want to talk."
"Should I go down?" asked Rek.
"Better if I do. The Nadir know me. Deathwalker. I'm part of their legends. They think I'm an ancient god of death stalking the world."
"Are they wrong, I wonder?" said Rek, smiling.
"Maybe not. I never wanted it, you know. All I wanted was to get my wife back. Had slavers not taken her, I would have been a farmer. Of that I am sure, though Rowena doubted it. There are times when I do not much like what I am."
"I'm sorry, Druss. It was a jest," said Rek. "I do not see you as a death god. You are a man and a warrior, but most of all, a man."
"It's not you, boy. Your words only echo what I already feel. I shall die soon, here at this dross. And what will I have achieved in my life? I have no sons nor daughters, no living kin, few friends. They will say, 'Here lies Drass. He killed many and birthed none.'"
"They will say more than that," said Virai suddenly. "They'll say, 'Here lies Drass the legend, who was never mean, petty, nor needlessly cruel. Here was a man who never gave in, never compromised his ideals, never betrayed a friend, never despoiled a woman, and never used his strength against the weak.' They'll say, 'He had no sons, but many a woman asleep with her babes slept more soundly for knowing Drass stood with the Drenai.' They'll say many things, Whitebeard. Through many generations they will say them, and men with no strength will find strength when they hear them."
"That would be pleasant," said the old man, smiling.
The morning drifted by, and the dross shone in the warm sunlight. One of the soldiers produced a flute and began to play a lilting springtime melody that echoed down the valley, a song of joy in a time of death. At midday, Rek and Drass were summoned to the ramparts. The Nadir had fallen back to Eldebar, but at the center of the killing ground was a man seated on a huge purple rug. He was eating a meal of dates and cheese and sipping wine from a golden goblet. Thrust into the ground behind him was a standard sporting a wolf's head. "He's certainly got style," said Rek, admiring the man instantly.
"I ought to go down before he finishes the food," said Drass. "We lose face as we wait."
"Be careful," urged Rek.
"There are only a couple of thousand of them," answered Drass, with a broad wink.
Hand over hand, he lowered himself to the Eldebar ground below and strolled towards the diner.
"I am a stranger in your camp," he said.
The man looked up. His face was broad and clean-cut, the jaw firm. The eyes were violet and slanted beneath dark brows. They were eyes of power.
"Welcome, stranger, and eat," said the man.
Drass sat cross-legged opposite him. Slowly the man unbuckled his lacquered black breastplate and removed it, laying it carefully at his side. Then he removed his black greaves and forearm straps. Druss noted the powerful muscles of the man's arms and the smooth, cat-like movements. "A warrior born," thought the old man. "I am Ulrich of the Wolf's Head. I am Druss of the Axe. Well met. Eat." Druss took a handful of dates from the silver platter before him and ate slowly. He followed this with goat's milk cheese and washed it down with a mouthful of red wine. His eyebrows rose. "Lentrian red," said Ulrich. "Without poison." Druss grinned. "I'm a hard man to kill. It's a talent." "You did well. I am glad for you. I was grieved to hear of your son. I have no sons, but I know how hard it is for a man to lose a loved one." "It was a cruel blow," said Ulrich. "He was a good boy. But then all life is cruel, is it not? A man must rise above grief." Druss was silent, helping himself to more dates. "You are a great man, Druss. I am sorry you are to die here."
"Yes, it would be nice to live forever. On the other hand, I am beginning to slow down. Some of your men have been getting damn close to marking me. It's an embarrassment."
"There is a prize for the man who killed you. 100 horses, picked from my own stable."
"How does the man prove to you that he slew me?"
"He brings me your head and 2 witnesses to the blow."
"Don't allow that information to reach my men. They will do it for 50 horses."
"I think not. You have done well. How is the new Earl settling in?"
"He would have preferred a less noisy welcome, but I think he is enjoying himself. He fights well, as do you all. It will not be enough, however."
"We shall see," said Druss.
"These dates are very good. Do you believe you can stop me? Tell me truly, Deathwalker." "I would like to have served under you," said Druss. "I have admired you for years. I have served many kings. Some are weak, others willful. Many were fine men. But you have the mark of greatness. I think you will get what you want eventually. But not while I live." "You will not live long, Druss," said Ulrich gently. "We have a shaman who knows these things. He told me that he saw you standing at the gates of Wall 4, Sumitos, I believe it is called, and the grinning skull of death floated above your shoulders." Druss laughed aloud. "Death always floats where I stand, Ulrich. I am he who walks with death. Does your shaman not know your own legends? I may choose to die at Sumitos. I may choose to die at Musif. But wherever I choose to die, know this. As I walk into the Valley of Shadows, I will take with me more than a few nadir for company on the road."
"They will be proud to walk with you. Go in peace." Chapter 23. Bloody day followed bloody day, an endless succession of hacking, slaying, and dying. Skirmishes carrying groups of Nadir warriors out onto the killing ground before Musiv and threatening to trap the Drenai army on the walls. But always they were beaten back and the line held. Slowly, as Serbitar had predicted, the strong were separated from the weak. It was easy to tell the difference. By the 6th week, only the strong survived. 3,000 Drenai warriors were either dead or had been removed from the battle with horrifying injuries. Druss strode like a giant along the ramparts day after day, defying all advice to rest, daring his weary body to betray him, drawing on hidden reserves of strength from his warrior's soul. Rek also was building a name, though he cared not. Twice his Beersark attacks had dismayed the Nadir and shattered their line. Orin still fought with the remnants of Karnak, now only 18 strong. Gilad fought beside him on the right, and on his left was Bregan, still using the captured axe. Hogun had gathered 50 of the Legion about him, and stood back from the rampart line, ready to fill in any gap that developed. The days were full of agony and the screams of the dying, and the list in the Hall of the Dead grew longer at every sunrise. Don Pinar fell, his throat torn apart by a jagged dagger. Bar Britan was found under a mound of Nadir bodies, a broken lance jutting from his chest. Tall Antaheim of the 30 was struck by a javelin in the back. Elikas of the Legion was trapped by the rampart towers as he hurled himself at the Nadir, screaming defiance, and fell beneath a score of blades. Jorak, the huge outlaw, had his brains dashed out by a club, and dying grabbed two Nadir warriors and threw himself from the battlements, dragging them screaming to their deaths on the rocks below. Amid the chaos of slashing swords, many deeds of individual heroism passed unseen. One young soldier, battling back to back with Drass, saw an enemy lancer bearing down on the old man. Unthinking, he threw himself in the way of the flashing steel point to die writhing among the other broken bodies on the ramparts. Another soldier, an officer named Portitak, leapt into the breach near the gate tower and stepped onto the ramparts, where he seized the top of a ladder and flung himself forward, pulling the ladder out from the wall. 20 Nadir near the top died with him on the rocks, and 5 others broke limbs. Many were such tales of bravery. And still the battles raged. Rek now sported a slanting scar from eyebrow to chin, gleaming red as he battled on. Orin had lost 3 fingers from his left hand, but after only 2 days behind the lines, he joined his men once more on the wall. From the capital at Drenan, the messages came endlessly. Hold on. Give Woundweaver time. Just 1 more month. And the defenders knew they could not hold. But still they fought on. Twice the Nadir tried night attacks, but on both occasions Serbitar warned the defenders, and the assailants paid dearly for their efforts. At night, handholds were difficult to find, and the long climb to the battlements was fraught with peril. Hundreds of tribesmen died without need for the touch of Drenai steel or a black-shafted arrow. Now the nights were silent, and in some ways as bad as the days, for the peace and tranquillity of the moon darkness acted as a weird counterpoint to the crimson agonies of the sunlight. Men had time to think, to dream of wives, children, farms, and even more potently, of a future that might have been. Hogun and Bowman had taken to walking together on the battlements at night, the grim Legion general and the bright, witty outlaw. Hogun found that in Bowman's company he could forget the loss of Elikas. He could even laugh again. For his part, Bowman felt a kinship with the Gan, for he too had a serious side, although he kept it well hidden. But on this particular night, Bowman was in a more melancholy mood, and his eyes were distant. "What ails you, man?" asked Hogun. "Memories," answered the archer, leaning over the ramparts to stare at the Nadir campfires below. "They must be either very bad or very good to touch you so." "These are very bad, my friend. Do you believe in gods?" "Sometimes. Usually when my back is against a wall and the enemy surrounds me," said Hogun. "I believe in the twin powers of growth and malevolence. I believe that on rare occasions each of these powers chooses a man and in different ways destroys him."
"And these powers have touched you, Bowman?" asked Hogun gently.
"Perhaps. Think back on recent history. You'll find examples."
"I do not need to. I know where this tale is leading," said Hogun.
"What do you know?" asked the archer, turning to face the dark-cloaked officer. Hogun smiled gently, though he noted that Bowman's fingers were curled around the hilt of his dagger.
"I know that you are a man whose life has been marred by some secret tragedy. A wife dead, a father slain, something.
There may even be some dark deed which you perpetrated and cannot forget. But even if that were the case, the very fact you remember it with such pain means that you acted out of character. Put it behind you, man. Who among us can change the past?
I wish I could tell you, said Bowman. But I cannot. I'm sorry, I am not fit company this evening. You go on. I will stay here a while.
Hogan wanted to clap his hand on the other's shoulder and say something witty to break the mood, as Bowman had so often done for him. But he could not. There were times when a grim-faced warrior was needed, even loved. But this was not one of them, and he cursed himself and left silently. For over an hour, Bowman stood on the ramparts, staring out over the valley, listening to the faint songs of the Nadir women drifting out from the far camp below.
"You are troubled," said a voice.
Bowman swung round to face Wreck. The young earl was dressed in the clothes in which he had arrived, thigh-length doeskin boots, a high-collared tunic with gold-embroidered collar and a reversed sheepskin jerkin. By his side was his longsword.
"I am merely tired," said Bowman. "I too. Is my scar fading?"
Bowman peered closely at the jagged red line from brow to chin.
"You were lucky not to lose an eye," he commented.
"Useless Nadir steel," said Wreck. "I made a perfect block, and his blasted sword snapped and lashed across my face. Good gods, man, have you any idea how long I've protected my face?"
"It's too late to worry about that now," said Bowman, grinning. "Some people are born ugly," said Wreck. "It's not their fault, and I, for one, have never held it against a man that he is ugly. But others, and I count myself among them, are born with handsome features. That is a gift which should not be lightly taken away."
"I take it you made the perpetrator pay for his deed?"
"Naturally. And, you know, I think he was smiling even as I slew him. But then he was an ugly man. I mean, really ugly. It's not right."
"Life can be so unfair," agreed Bowman. "But you must look on the bright side, my Lord Earl. You see, unlike me, you were never stupendously handsome. Merely well-featured. The brows were too thick, the mouth a shade too wide, and your hair is now growing a little thinner. Now, had you been blessed with the near miraculous good looks possessed by such as I, you would have truly had something to grieve over."
"There is something in what you say," said Wreck. "You have indeed been greatly blessed. It was probably nature's way of making up to you for being short."
"Short? I'm almost as tall as you."
"Ah, but what a large word almost is. Can a man be almost alive, almost right?
In the question of height, my friend, we do not deal in subtle shades of grey. I am taller, you are shorter. But I would concur there is not a more handsome, short man at the fortress."
"Women have always found me the perfect height," said Bowman. "At least, when I dance with them, I can whisper love words in their ears. With your long shanks, their heads would nestle near your armpit."
"You had a lot of time for dancing in the forest, do you?" asked Wreck amiably.
"I didn't always live in the forest. My family..."
Bowman stuttered to silence. "I know your family background," said Wreck. "But it's about time you talked about it. You've carried it too long."
"How could you know?"
"Serbitar told me. As you know, he has been inside your mind, when you carried his messages to Drass."
"I suppose the entire damned fortress knows," said Bowman. "I will leave at dawn. Only Serbitar and I know the story, and the truth of it. But leave if you will. The truth of it is that I killed my father and brother." Bowman was white-faced and tense.
"Twin accidents. You know it well," said Wreck. "Why must you torture yourself?"
"Why? Because I wonder at accidents in life. I wonder how many are caused by our own secret desires. There was a foot racer once, the finest I ever saw. He was preparing for the great games, to run for the first time against the fastest men from many nations. On the day before the race, he fell and twisted his ankle.
Was it really an accident? Or was he frightened to face the great test? Only he will ever know, said Rek. But therein lies the secret. He knows, and so should you. Serbitar tells me that you were hunting with your father and brother. Your father was to the left, your brother to the right, when you followed a deer into the thicket. A bush before you rustled, and you aimed and let the arrow fly. But it was your father who had come unannounced. How could you know he would do such a thing? The point is that he taught us never to shoot until we saw the target. So you made a mistake. What else is new on the face of the world? And my brother? He saw what you had done, misunderstood, and ran at you in a rage. You pushed him away and he fell, striking his head on a rock. No one would wish such a burden on themselves. But you have nursed it, and it is now time for you to release it. I never loved my father or my brother, said Bowman. My father killed my mother. He left her alone for months and had many mistresses. When my mother took one lover, he had him blinded and her slain. Horribly. I know. Don't dwell on it. And my brother was made in his image. This also I know. And do you know what I felt when they were both lying dead at my feet? Yes, you were exultant. And is that not terrible? I don't know if you have considered this, Bowman, but think on it. You blame the gods for bringing a curse upon you, but the curse really fell on the two men who deserved it. I don't know yet whether I fully believe in fate, but certain things do happen in a man's life which he cannot explain. My being here, for instance, Druss's conviction that he will die here, for he has made a pact with death. And you? But I do believe that you were merely an instrument of, who knows, a law of natural justice, perhaps? Whatever you believe about yourself, know this. Serbitar searched your heart, and he found no malice there. And he knows. Perhaps, said Bowman. Then he grinned suddenly. Have you noticed that when Serbitar removes that horsehair helm, he is shorter than I am?
The room was spartanly furnished. A rug, a pillow, and a chair, all bunched beneath the small window by which the albino stood, naked and alone. Moonlight bathed his pale skin, and the night breeze ruffled his hair. His shoulders were bowed, his eyes closed. Weariness was upon him like no other weariness he had felt in all his young life, for it was born of the spirit and the truth. The philosophers often talked of lies sitting under the tongue like salted honey. This, Serbitar knew, was true enough. But more often the hidden truth was worse, far worse, for it settled in the belly and grew to engulf the spirit. Below him were the Vagrian quarters, which housed Suboden and the 300 men who had come from Dros Segril. For several days he had fought alongside his personal bodyguard and become again the prince of Dros Segril, son of Earl Drada. But the experience had been painful, for his own men had made the sign of the protective horn as he approached. They rarely spoke to him, and then only to answer a direct question speedily. Suboden, blunt-speaking as always, had asked the albino to return to his comrades. We are here, Prince Serbitar, because it is our duty. This we will accomplish best without you beside us. More painful than this, however, was the long discussion he had had with the Abbot of Swords, the man he revered, loved as a father, mentor, and friend. Serbitar closed his eyes and opened his mind, soaring free of the body prison and sweeping aside the curtains of time. Back he travelled, back and further back. 13 long, wearisome, joy-filled years flowed past him, and he saw again the caravan which had brought him to the Abbot of Swords. Riding at the head of 10 warriors is the giant red-bearded Drada, the young Earl of Segril, battle-hardened, volatile, a pitiless enemy, but a true friend. Behind him, 10 of his most trusted warriors, men who would die for him without a moment's hesitation,
for they love him above life. At the rear is a cart upon which, on a straw pallet covered with silken sheets, lies the young prince, a canvas screen shielding his ghost-white face from the sun. Drada wheels the black horse round and gallops back to the cart. He leans on his saddle horn and glances down at the boy. The boy looks up, framed against the bright sky. He can see only the flaring wings of his father's battle helmet. The cart is moving again, into the shade of the ornate black gates. They swing open and a man appears. "I bid you welcome, Drada," he says, the voice at variance with the silver armor he wears, for it is a gentle sound, the voice of a poet. "I bring you my son," answers the earl, his voice gruff, soldierly. Vintar moves to the cart and looks down on the boy. He places a hand on the pale forehead, smiles and pats the boy's head. "Come, walk with me, boy," he says.
"He cannot walk," says Drada.
"But he can," says Vintar. The boy turns his red eyes towards